Hi everyone, welcome to our podcast series, What About Us? Cultural Awareness in Clinical Psychology. I'm Afsana. So in today's episode, I am joined by Leila Lawton, who is a CBT therapist working in London, amongst many other roles. So I had Leila talk a little bit about her research that she presented at the EABCT conference this year in Belfast, and it was titled, Is CBT Only for White People? So Leila talks a little bit about her research, thinking about adaptations that can be made when working with racially minoritized groups, and gives some advice for fellow clinical practitioners out there who may be working with such groups. So let's have a listen to what Leila had to say.
So hi Leila, thank you so much for joining me in today's episode. So before we kind of start, if you can start by telling me a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay, so I'm a cognitive behavioral psychotherapist. I'm also a clinical supervisor. I do a little bit of lecturing part-time, and I'm also chair of the South London and Morsley NHS Trust Race Equity Working Group. And I also am affiliated with the BABCP Equality and Cultural Special Interest Group.
Wow, so there's definitely a lot going on there, isn't there?
There's a lot going on. There's a lot going on, Afsana. But all of a sudden, there's so many opportunities and platforms to be doing this work. You just want to jump on as many as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who don't know, we actually met at the EABCT conference in Belfast, didn't we? And I mean, it was great. I met you for the first time there. I kind of knew you a little bit from Twitter. So I'd seen some of the stuff that you were posting, but I didn't actually know who you were. And I think, you know, we got on really well. Well, I think I got on really well.
I mean, I think we were firm sisters within that period of time. It was emotional and fun and informative. There was just so much there. I also knew about you from Twitter as well. It was such a privilege to meet you in person. And we had such a blast.
We did. So I'm going to kind of get you to talk a little bit about your sort of the talk that you did. It was titled, Is CBT for White People? And I think that's something that's so important, and it's a piece of research that I think, you know, I really wanted you to kind of touch upon. So I'm going to pass it over to you just to talk a little bit about what that was about and just some of your findings and, you know, how you came up with that concept and idea.
Well, basically, particularly throughout the pandemic, actually, being able to kind of access a lot of different webinars, there was a lot of activism first going on, and trying to cope with the weight of emotion attached to so much going on with disproportionality in COVID deaths, in particular with racially minoritized communities, also with the really high profile kind of deaths of poor George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery. Just a few numbers, statistics we know are incredibly high and have been for a number of years. I was just kind of entering different spaces where I was being fronted with different people who were really kind of talking about how they didn't really feel that cognitive behavioral therapy was appropriate, and it was very much perhaps only for people who identified as white from the white Western populations. And I know in my experience as a working within this modality for about 7 years, and also just working with people really for over 16 years, I just find it fascinating. And but I also understood that cultural humility in terms of providing psychologically safe spaces was integral to the therapeutic alliance and to building relationship, and having that sense of like real curiosity around culture but with respect was really necessary. But that racism and microaggressions and also racism on a more systemic level was being kind of exposed in a way that I hadn't really seen before. And having been working on this paper for a couple of years, it just felt like the right time to do that. I think to do a talk entitled "Is CBT Only for White People?" And I suppose you've got a leading question you want to ask me in relation to that, Afsana.
Absolutely. Yeah, so tell me, is it for white people? I mean, I don't know.
I mean, you have to answer the question.
Yes, well, tell
basically,
me.
Basically, in true politician form, I think that what we found is that we really need to kind of unpack what anti-racist practice is and how, you know, with white Western populations, often the evidence base, not just in cognitive behavioral therapy, but in a range of different therapy modalities, the majority of the population samples are white. So effectively, we're not seeing that high level representation from different community groups and different racially minoritized community groups. So on paper, it does look like it's very effective, but is there a disconnect? So then we look at the figures. What do we see? And I'm speaking specifically around IACT here, but who's accessing services and who's not? Because how do we know if it's working? We know by the amount of people that are coming in. We know by their outcomes, their experiences. And what was that telling us? We know that there's a certain population of people that are overrepresented in secondary care and who are offered more likely to be offered a pharmacological intervention, more likely to not be offered psychological therapies. And why is that so? Why are people from racially minoritized communities not offered and not accessing psychological therapies, given that this has been accessible since 2008 when improving access to psychological therapies kind of landed? Where have we made any progress there? What I would say is that there has been some progress. The statistics show there's been some progress, but not enough, because people aren't accessing services as much as they should be. And that's that. Services really need to consider what it is that they need to do. But it's not just a service level, it's an individual level. Because if in training, issues around racism, discrimination, microaggression are not discussed, if opportunities to be reflexive and think about the power imbalance that people hold and think about the need for cultural safety and cultural humility, if people aren't familiar with those terms and aren't supported to explore what it means for them and to explore their own bias and their own prejudice, which everyone has, then it's a problem. And what we found is that if there are people who are open to continual learning in terms of cultural competence, because it's a lifelong pursuit, it's not something that anyone is ever going to arrive at, but are kind of really committed to creating cultural safety, to learning about anti-racist practice, and to want to engage people and be aware of their bias in that individual therapeutic encounter, then there is hope. But how do we look at that in terms of how we formulate? How do we kind of conceptualize problems? Do we understand the societal context? Because often we can't just look at what's happening right here, right now, actually, because fundamentally we all exist within systems and we've been positioned in terms of where we are in society and who makes those decisions about how we're positioned. We have to understand the historical context. And that's what kind of my paper really provoked me to go on a journey of discovering, learning and understanding, drawing on my own lived experience and kind of building on that, kind of really researching what the evidence shows and what's not showing and what is lacking. Fundamentally, what we found is it's only if there is a willingness to change things from a systemic level and from a micro level, from that therapeutic encounter, that CBT would not just be for white people. So that's very much dependent on the services, but also the training provisions that are out there in terms of supporting people to be practitioners that are reflexive, that are committed to anti-racist practice. Because the problems aren't just in psychotherapy, we know that. The problems are within our systems and within our society. But if we acknowledge them, then we can move forward, because we don't live in an equal society. And I'm conscious of...
No.
I might just pause there, in case you had a question for me.
No, that's perfect. Thank you. I think I've got a couple of things just to pick up on. So in terms of your kind of role as a clinician, as a practitioner, I first of all wonder what kind of sort of challenges have you come across, or some of the things that you think that service users who are from ethnic minority communities, when you kind of think of it from that respect, what are some of the challenges that you've kind of encountered within therapy? So I'll start off with that question first, and then I'll move on to the more therapist side of it.
So within therapy, I think that when it comes to language, I'll talk about that. There could be a range of things, but when it comes to having information that is in a range of different languages to support people's understanding, the pandemic has made it even harder, I think, for people that don't speak English as a first language, refugees and asylum seekers. I think the biggest challenges are where there are a range of needs in terms of holistic needs, looking at the whole person, housing, employment, benefits. When people don't have understanding of the system, when people don't feel safe already, and they don't have the support and advocacy to access these other key thing, warm, just to have food, just to be able to have a decent place to live. These are core things that people take for granted, but often a number of people within our society don't have access to those things. And then to provide an authentic therapeutic encounter, you cannot ignore those things. You have to make sure that people are anchored and supported to access support within their communities. So I think it's really important. I think some of the challenges are about understanding the systems, having contact within community organizations, having contacts within employment organizations, with social care, to make sure that you can link people in and give them that comprehensive picture. Because sometimes the challenges are that before you can even start the therapeutic intervention, you need to make sure that those foundations have been laid, that there is some level of support in terms of those different areas. People don't come in neat packages. You know, life is happening for people, you know, and therapy is integral and important, but it cannot ignore those other concerns and those other issues, whether it's to do with language or whether it's language and employment and housing and education, or it's independent and people can speak the language. There's still barriers for people in terms of understanding how these systems work. Sometimes time can be an issue, fast-paced environment, who's prioritizing what's important and what's not. I think there's a real kind of need for the people that kind of set the key performance indicators to recognize that they need to make sure that equity in terms of who's accessing the service, what their experiences are, and how their outcomes can be improved. If there aren't key performance indicators around these things, then we can't really move forward, because fundamentally this is not a tick box exercise. And I think sometimes some of the biggest critics of IAPT and CBT is that kind of the business model behind it. I mean, it's got its pros and cons, and I think we would need a lot longer time to really kind of unpick that. But fundamentally, the offer that we have that is free, that is widely accessible in every borough, we need to make sure that people in communities who don't have access to the internet, who don't even have access to food sometimes and those basic needs necessities can go there and can access it. We need to go into the communities. And my biggest challenge is, you know, obviously there's COVID and there's restrictions, but it's about building those relationships. And the biggest challenge is having time to do that, having time to develop the resources when you're working, when the challenge and the conflicts and the constraints within this business model of IAPT are there. That in itself is a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I think this is something that's kind of brought up time and time again within literature as well, you know, talking about not just therapy in itself, but sort of the wider social cultural context as well. So I totally agree with everything that you're saying there. But I guess when I'm kind of just thinking about CBT, you know, if we think of CBT as a therapy in itself in isolation, how do you think that is received with ethnic minority communities? You know, do they understand the model? Do they understand, you know, the formulation process and all of that kind of stuff? So how well is that received within sort of these groups?
I think in my experience, it's very much about who is delivering the therapy, in terms of understanding of societal context, understanding of prejudice, because to be honest with you, the therapy, people don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I think if you can put that across in that interaction that you're having with somebody, you've already got them, they're already a bit open to hear what you've got to say. I think that I have seen with adaptation, and you have to consider kind of people's context in terms of their culture, in terms of their own experiences, where there's a willingness to learn and explore that. These models can be highly effective. They definitely have to be adapted because it's not one size fits all. That's the point I'm making. And I think what's going to really revolutionize cognitive behavioral psychotherapy is targeted research in different populations and different representative populations. That's where we're going to see real growth and better engagement. But if we just think about the core principles of the positive practice guide that was developed for racially minoritized communities, that was written by Psychanaz Andrew Beck, Michelle Brooks Uchega, and Maya, her surname, forgive me, I can't recall her surname right now, but they did a lot of work looking at the literature already, setting up different pilots and different studies that kind of really fed into the outcomes and the audit tool for the guide, which is very practical and digestible and considers key areas that services need to think about. And I think if those things are thought about, if the audit tool is used, if there is a key performance indicator to make it a formal requirement that it is used, I think that there is hope for better engagement and more authentic and meaningful interactions with people, because there's a range of different formulations, there's different methodologies when we're thinking about different types of illnesses or conditions people may be struggling with from time to time, which are really common for all of us. But we need to understand people from where they're coming from before we try to impose any level of a model or a formulation. In order to conceptualize, in order to understand, we need to understand that person. What's their background? Where were they? Where did they grow up? What were their values? What was important to them? Because they won't not always match our own experiences. So we can't make assumptions. We need to come very open, completely clear, and open-minded to hear and receive, and know that these people that we're supporting have a wealth of knowledge and inner resources that for whatever reason, life has meant at that time, there's certain key life events that may have affected them and caused them to lose sight of a lot of the inner resources and the skills that they have. Being displaced and disconnected when you're an asylum seeker or a refugee, or even just moving to another part of the country, you know, if you're somebody, a victim of the Windrush generation where everything's been taken from you, your job, your home, your security, your actual nationality stripped because of a racist system, you know, how do you then begin to work with somebody without acknowledging the damage that the system has done? You know, I think it's a very multi-layered thing, really, Afsana. And I think it's very much dependent on the person providing the therapeutic intervention. And if that person has got that understanding and that compassion and care, they will do the research, find out about Afghanistan, find out about people from Cyprus, find out about people from Vietnam. If those people are in your demographic, are they in your local representative population? If you don't know about them, get to know. Get to know. There's a lot of people that have contributed to this country, to this the economy here, that have got amazing skill sets. We understand that in media, even, the representation is often quite negative. There's lots of marked identities. There's lots of othering for certain groups. So we know that what's projected out there has an impact. If we think about the Dole's test that was completed in the 1940s by the leading kind of psychologists, Dr. Marmee Clark. It's what's interesting is even now, 2016, in some of the teaching I deliver, there's been a kind of a replication of that video, of that of that experiment with young people from 2016, and there is very little change in terms of how young people of certain racially minoritized communities see themselves, and how does that happen at the age of 3, 4, or 5? How are people taught what their worth is based on their skin color? What kind of conditioning is happening in schools? What kind of conditioning is happening in terms of what people are exposed to away from the home? And also we have to think about internal prejudice. What are people given off as a result of how they're being treated? You know, we see that with colorism. There's so many layers to this, Afsana. I don't even know if I'm doing you justice in responding to what you've actually asked me.
You absolutely are.
I'm going off on so many different tangents. I'm so
sorry. No, you are. You are. Sorry, you've actually no, you absolutely are. And you've just said that you've just lost. I had a question for you, but I've just like lost my frame of mind. Right. So what I was going to ask you next was, so you kind of talked a bit about, you know, sort of targeting certain groups, tailoring, you know, therapy for you know, certain demographics and so on. And I know that you recently kind of wrote a paper around, you know, access and adaptations for Black and African Caribbean communities. So I know that you've kind of touched upon some of these things already in your sort of conversation, but I guess if I kind of go on to like talking about adaptations in particular, what kind of things would a clinician or someone need to consider when we're kind of thinking about these things with sort of minoritized communities?
I think when we kind of are getting an understanding of somebody's problem and somebody's difficulty, genograms can be really helpful in terms of thinking about the context where people are positioned and placed within their family,
right?
Who's around them? What the support networks are, and that's probably quite standard to cognitive behavioral psychotherapy. But I think with genograms, it might go a step further. It might think about grandparents and great grandparents. It might think about movement. It might think about where people, how long people have been in this, whether they're first generation, second generation. Those things are quite integral in terms of understanding people and how they see themselves. But also to be able to actually introduce and give permission to people to talk about things to do with discrimination is really key. I wonder about how many people feel that they can actually speak about that as part of their experience. What we found in the last year or so in delivering workshops that are specifically for people from racially minoritized, ethnically minoritized communities is that issues with discrimination come up very much, particularly in the work context. That's what we're seeing kind of in terms of our early feedback and experiences of what people are sharing. And I think people need to be confident enough to share about some of these things in the session. And I know that I'm not given an exact science or like a, you know, a step-by-step guide. What I'm saying is there is no step-by-step guide. It's just about understanding racism and being open to talk about it. It's about understanding oppression and being open to talk about it. It's about understanding What do you mean sitting across from that person over the video screen or whether it's face to face? Do you know what your skin color might mean to them? Have you been able to explore that or kind of tentatively check in with them about how it feels for them being in that position? Have you made them feel comfortable to know that the power is shared? It's supposed to be about collaboration in cognitive behavioral psychotherapy interactions, but often there's a lot of power that's placed on the therapist in any context. But I think it's about being able to recognize the power and understand what it is living in a world where whiteness is the dominant culture, and there is a level of supremacy linked in with whiteness. Mm-hmm. I think in order to be able to work with people using cultural sensitivity, whether you're adapting your formulations or whether you're being sensitive or displaying humility and respect, you can't do that without being aware of your own white fragility. So I think that the positive practice guide outlines what cultural sensitivity and what cultural adaptations are, and I'd really encourage people to read and go there to find out, because it's not a quick fix, but actually when you look at it, it's not that complicated either, you know. But if people don't get the key concepts of power, of racism, of colonization, of imperialism, then I think it's a challenge. And so I think training needs to really start from that point. My paper started from the historical context, because we know that the mental health system does kind of walk hand in hand with key events in history, whether it's the civil rights movement or partitioning, where there has been oppression and it has suited the dominant culture to use different means to oppress. And I think we have to acknowledge and recognize that and understand how these long lasting legacies of oppression exist now within our systems. We cannot right the wrongs of the past, but we can work to address the ongoing impact. Again, I'm not really sure if I've answered your question.
No, absolutely. No, you have. I think just something that just kind of came to mind, and I think this is something that I've kind of come across through just, you know, people we've spoken through on the podcast, and also, you know, just clinicians I've met on the daily, whether it's through our mentoring scheme and so on. And I guess one of the things, which I probably just want your kind of take on, one of the things that come up and has come up through my research as well, actually, is those who identify as white kind of having concerns around getting it wrong. So, you know, them being in a therapy room or whatever it is with, whether it's, you know, service users or students or whatever it is, depending on what capacity they're engaging with someone from ethnic minority background. It's that fear of getting it wrong. And it's that fear of, you know, holding that position of power and how that might be perceived by the other. So what kind of things would you, or what advice would you give those individuals? Because, you know, this can be a very sensitive topic area. And I guess, you know, it's something that, you know, and I don't believe that, you know, everyone out there or all the clinicians out there, you know, necessarily try to avoid this conversation. But I guess it's that, like I said, that kind of fear of getting it wrong. So what would be your advice to them?
I think the dialogue needs to start in the therapy room, but supervision and reflective practice, clinical practice spaces need to kind of work alongside the work that we do, as always. And I think it calls for an honesty, and I think it calls for an openness for the discomfort, because often I think it's quite important for people to consider that the majority of the people that I see, Asana, won't look like me. And have I experienced times where I felt like there are racist undertones or an expectation of not, you know, surprise at not having a white therapist, and even, you know, anger at a low level, you know, that you have to kind of unpick? What I would say to those therapists that that are struggling and fearful of getting it wrong is that we spend a lot of time in therapy trying to engage with the emotion in the room, the emotion of the people that we're supporting, their thought processes, try to understand their earlier experiences and their context and how that has kind of informed and shaped their identity. I would really encourage them to do work on finding out about the societal context and how racism impacts on people, so they can get a sense of an understanding to kind of make sure that they're getting continued professional development within their services that's looking at race and attending reflective practice spaces so they can be open and in a psychologically safe space to talk about that discomfort. And I'd encourage them to own it in the space, you know, own it the same way therapists who are Black or brown or any other ethnically minoritized identity, and they may have had to acknowledge the discomfort or the tension in a room with somebody sitting across from them or in a screen, and actually, you know, ask how they feel about having a therapist who is Black or who is Asian. Who's Black, who's brown, who is from the Gypsy, Roma Gypsy community or anything like that. Mm. Like, how does it feel to ask that question? I've had to ask that question, you know, and it's been it's been emotive. But actually, we've been on a process of discovery, myself and my patient, myself and the person that I'm supporting, the service user. We've been on a journey where we've been able to be safe enough to talk about what it means to be Black or brown or white, you know, what it means to have and share a space with somebody where there's power that is that goes against actually the norm, because what we've been led to believe and accept is, and this is the reality of our systems, is that the norm, the dominant culture who has the most knowledge and experience is centered around people, is centered around whiteness. Mm. And that's not actually accurate, you know, so it may feel uncomfortable for people, you know, but how about we acknowledge the discomfort, sit with it and work with it? Because the most beautiful moments in therapy come out of a level of emotion and a level of discomfort. If we're expecting for the people that we're supporting to be that open and make themselves that vulnerable, maybe we should try and tap into our own vulnerability there whilst maintaining that professional air, but still tapping into that humanistic side of ourselves to really engage with the process and recognize what's going on in the room and give that power to the person sitting across from that, from us, because we really need to ask ourselves, are we ready to share the power? Are we ready to hand it over? Who will benefit if we do?
Absolutely. And I love that term you use, process of discovery. And I think that's so important that, you know, and everyone is kind of feeling like they can kind of tap into, you know, these sensitive but also very important key, you know, parts of themselves, I suppose, you know, in that therapy room or even in the wider context. So I think that's amazing that you kind of, the way you've kind of put that together, actually. Leila,
Asana, can I just, I just wanted to say that also, I think it's really important to recognize the assumptions and stereotypes and prejudices that we have. You know, yeah. I don't have the monopoly. I always make that clear. I do not have the monopoly on diversity. I'm an African, British, Ugandan woman who has many intersectional layers. But what I do is I engage with those layers and I recognize the relational identities that I might have at different times with people, and I'm conscious of that, and I make changes to make it work for the person I'm supporting. Having that in mind, I also use supervision, to be honest, because there may be people that look like my daughter that I might have a bias towards, that I might give more time in therapy for or go the extra mile for. Would people who are white recognize that they may do that for people that are more like them as well? Can we just be honest about where we are right now and make changes and not make assumptions about people that look so different to us, come from different backgrounds that we may not understand? Do we make an effort to understand where they're coming from, or do we make judgments that aren't spoken but are felt? That is the real question.
That's deep. I mean, wow. What do I say to
that? I'm trying to make up for going off on a million tangents.
How do I respond to that? You know what? I agree with everything you're saying, to be honest. And I think, I mean, I don't know how to rephrase it. I mean, what you've said, right? Leila, I am conscious of time because I know that I've kept you for so long. Just one final thing before I kind of wrap this up. you go by the singing therapist. Please tell me how this is, I mean, you don't tell me because I know where this has come from. But for those who don't know, tell us a bit about where has this come from? Where has the title, the singing therapist, come from?
Oh, well, you know, Afsana, you know, I love to sing. I mainly sing gospel at my church, but I've always sang. And I think, like, you know, in my papers to come, perhaps, I really want to explore the role of singing and voice in terms of well-being, you know, and the impact, and in terms of thinking about trauma and new narratives. And actually what I've found in my experience as well is that the music and voice is very edifying, and it has cultural context, you know, for a lot of people. And I think we're bringing that into the groups that we're running, and I've seen that with the Black Association of the Association of Black Psychologists use it a lot in their work. And I think I've seen it with other people. I've seen it with different Asian therapists. And I think I really want to embrace and celebrate that. I think for me, my voice is a way of expressing emotion and whether that's joy, whether that's sadness. And as you know, Afsana, we dance the night away at Belfast. We were singing with the Irish band, and it was beautiful. So hashtag the singing therapist, more of that singing is to come.
Absolutely.
I think there's a whole other tale behind it, but you'll have to wait for the book, Afsana.
I mean, I felt like, you know, you were Beyonce and I was your backup dancer, you know. Nothing sharp felt the same, you know, we were your backup dancer.
We found Belfast, Afsana. We found it. It was the most beautiful thing. Those people are lovely.
It really was. And, you know, you were amazing. I'm so glad I met you. And I think this is, and I think just some of the, and we've touched upon this in the article that we're going to be kind of, you've put together recently. And I guess it's just, you know, just finally just touching on the fact that, you know, these kind of spaces, you know, making them available for like people like us who we can connect, you know, people who look like us, you know, talk like us, are from similar backgrounds, upbringing, all of that kind of stuff. I think is so important because, you know, if it hadn't been for this conference, I probably would never have met you. And I think it's just amazing to meet people like you, Saika, Shah, and so on. I think this is, you know, we need more of these opportunities, and, you know, they need to be more accessible to.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
I 100% agree with what you're saying, Afsana. And can I just say that you are an absolute blessing and a complete delight. I really, you know what? I can't tell you what a beautiful and timely experience it was at that conference. You, Shah, Daniela, Saika, Andrew, you know, and the people that were online with Vash, Michelle, Romana, there's just, you know, Monica, Peter, I mean, come on, it was absolutely incredible and life-changing. I'm not even exaggerating, you know. If I could do it again, I would, but it was just beautiful, honestly. And I'm really excited.
I need to add more lists to see, right? More lists.
We need to go again. We need to go again anyway and explore. I know you're good at exploring, Afsana. Okay.
Don't bait me out. Oh dear. Robert, I think I need to edit that part out now, don't I? Right, listen, Ada, I'm gonna have to wrap this up. I could talk to you for ages, and I guess, you know, we're gonna have to touch upon this in forthcoming months, you know, once you know we've got more things going on. This is going to be our last episode for this year, so thank you so much for bringing in your positive energy and, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
I really look forward to connecting with you more. I love what you're doing. I love your heart, your passion, your dedication, your expertise in this area. And it's a privilege to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. Thank you so much, Layla. Take care.
Take care, Afsana.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and I really hope that you take something away from this, because I certainly have. I've learned a lot from Layla and the wealth of experience that she has. So, as I mentioned in the interview, This is the last episode for 2021. So Kate and I are hoping to bring back new series for next year with some new ideas. So if you've got any feedback, comments, suggestions, please do get in touch. So I want to wish you all a lovely break, new year. Both Kate and I want to thank every single one of you for listening in, to all our speakers who have given up their time to join us this year. We hope you have a happy, safe, stress-free, restful break. And see you on the other side. Take care. Bye-bye.